Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, this is the ID the Future podcast with the CSC in Seattle, Washington. This is Casey Luskin, and we have with us in the studio today, again, Dr. Charles Thaxton, one of the founding scientists of the intelligent design movement, a chemist who, in many respects, put the term intelligent design on the map. And Dr. Thaxton recently did a podcast with us about his studies on the origin of life and his book, The Mystery of Life's Origin, which really made quite a stir for many years in terms of critiquing naturalistic origin of life hypotheses. Dr. Thaxton is here with us today, and he's going to talk about the origins of intelligent design and some of the early work that was actually going into the intelligent design direction of thinking. So, Dr. Thaxton, thank you again for doing these interviews with us.
Very good. I'm happy to be here.
Intelligent design obviously has a very long history. It goes all the way back to the Greeks. I assume you were not involved with it back then.
No, I'm not that old.
I didn't think so. And even into the 19th century, you can find a variety of scholars who explicitly use the term intelligent design, in some cases, you know, in very similar ways to the way that we use the term today. But it seems like the term was sort of forgotten in the sands of time for many decades in the 20th century until the 1970s and 1980s. So I'd like to first trace the origin of intelligent design thinking and then talk about the actual origin of the term intelligent design. What first got you thinking about the idea of intelligent design?
Well, in reading in science through history, one of the things that you come to are the Stoics. Way back, and Stoic writers spoke in terms of intelligent causes of phenomena. And they would use arguments very similar to what we would call the classical design arguments. And obviously, that literature has made its way through the Middle Ages down to us. And so it's difficult to find a period of history in which design arguments were not prominent.
I just want to get this straight, because something must be wrong with your history here, because intelligent design is supposed to be, you know, repackaged Christian theology. But you're saying that, you know, this argument started before the advent of Christianity.
Oh, of course, yes.
Okay. Okay. Very interesting.
I think it's it's as common as a child looking at things and recognizing that somebody made it.
Okay.
And it's no different than that. There are a lot of analogies that people have used over the years, but one of the ones that Stoic writers used was a building of a house. And the idea that you would certainly not think that a house just appeared, that it had to have intelligence to build it. And so that's not just a 20th century or 19th century literature. That's way back.
Sure.
In the more modern sense, how I got involved with doing with thinking in these terms was really trying to think about where the living system itself arose and arranged chemically. As a chemist, the word creation is a good legitimate word in the dictionary. Unfortunately for Westerners, it is also tied into many religious traditions. So every time you use the word creation, it automatically conjures up any of a number of religious discussions. And we knew from the very beginning of our project that turned out to be the making of pandas and people, that we wanted to avoid this automatically concluding that what you're talking about was religion, because in fact we were dealing with a biological discussion. So we were trying to operate entirely within the empirical domain. And my thought was how to arrive at a set of terms that would allow us to traffic the literature and the discussion and build an argument, and without having to use terminology that would automatically bring one into the religious realm. Mm. It so happens that anytime you're dealing with design, people automatically take leaps of logic and make conclusions that aren't necessarily warranted. But we did what we could do to stay within the empirical domain and make legitimate inferences. And yes, I'll leave it at that point.
No, this is really fascinating. I think I want to come back to the origin of the intelligent design terminology again, maybe later on in this podcast. Let's go back a little bit, though, to the origin of this idea that there was, you know, mind and intelligence involved. In the previous podcast, you mentioned that Michael Polanyi had hinted about this, that there was I think you said something like an information generative event. Was it something like that?
He called it a profoundly informative intervention.
Okay, all right.
Rather provocative phrase.
Okay, but when you read Polanyi's work in the 60s, this got you thinking about what type of an event was necessary to generate the ordered sequence, the specified and complex sequence of nucleotides in our DNA. And I think it's okay for us to just use that jargon because I think many of our listeners are familiar
right.
with it. So what orders the nucleotides in the DNA? So can you rehash for us how that kind of thinking played a role in your development of intelligent design?
Well, in its first place, the notion of an intelligent cause in the physical sciences, or that was the big barrier that had to be crossed.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't done. It in the 20th century, mm-hmm. When we first started doing our project, it was primarily a critique of Origin of Life literature and experiments. And the more I got into the study of it, and the more complex it got, the more I realized that there was something new going on here. That before the 1950s, there just were not the recognition of molecules that are known as informational molecules today.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that time, early, say 51, 52, was the very beginning in which it was concluded that proteins themselves are aperiodic, or say they are irregular polymers. That would be a good way to put it. That they are a polymer of many units, amino acids, in a consecutive order, but they have to be put together in a particular way. That mm-hmm. was not known before. So in that sense, proteins and DNA, although they had been known before,
mm-hmm.
what their structure was in terms mm-hmm. of a linear sequence of parts had not been known.
Mm.
And when that became known, and then it was clear that there had to be a code to relate one set of sequences in the DNA to the other set of sequences in a protein, at that point it was clear that there was a genetic code. And then as soon as you start talking about codes, many people start thinking in terms of intelligence.
Mm.
But the scientific community wanted to say, no, well, that's only a metaphor. And so I went through my training, my education, instilling in myself, this is only a metaphor. And then eventually, in the process of studying it, it occurred to me one day, wait a minute, at what point does a metaphor cease to be a metaphor, and it's really and something that was arranged by intelligence? And so I'm not sure exactly when that was, but when that began to occur to me, that was the dawning of a whole new way to approach the problem.
Mm.
And that was somewhere in the late 70s.
I heard you give a talk recently, Dr. Thaxton, where I was very impressed because you obviously are very well versed in philosophy of science, especially the historical sciences and how they work. And I know from reading Pandas and People and many of your other works that there's a lot of historical science and philosophy of science in those books, and it's so foundational to your argument. And being a geologist, I'm a big fan of historical sciences and uniformitarianism, that sort of thing. But you have a quote that you quoted from David Hume, which says, "From causes which appear similar, we accept similar effects. The same rule holds whether the cause assigned be brute, unconscious matter, or a rational, intelligent being. How does that kind of reasoning underlie intelligent design theory?
Well, one day I was reading Hume's an inquiry concerning human understanding, and ran across these passages. And I thought, now that's interesting. I knew Hume was considered a skeptic in religious terms and so on. Mm-hmm. But in the 20th century, the discussion had always been in terms of natural versus supernatural. We think that like that. And in terms of science, we're looking for natural processes. But when I read Hume, it jumped out at me. Oh, well, intelligent cause is also a valid inference according to what Hume is talking about. Mm. So I began to read Hume more carefully. In fact, eventually, when The Mystery of Life's Origin was finally published, I made sure that Anthony Flew, who was the world's leading scholar on David Hume at the time, got a copy of our book. And he was kind enough to write a review for us and send it back. And I did so because I had consciously leaned upon David Hume to try to develop the argument that I was trying to develop, to couch it this way. Because I knew if I did so, at least philosophically, it would pass muster with the great master himself in that regard. I believe that as long as we go from the realm of the empirical, it is legitimate to make an inference to either natural cause or intelligent cause. Mm-hmm. And we tried to be very clear about this in Pandas particularly, mm-hmm. because it came after Mystery mm-hmm. was published, and we began to refine the argument more. Also, you recognize, maybe we haven't talked about it yet, but Mystery was done consciously with the notion that the results of this book and what we learned there could be applied more generally mm-hmm. to the whole of biology.
Okay.
So the notion of information, as we discussed it in Mystery, we realized it could be, it's the essential package that needs to be parlayed into the rest of biology. Hmm. And that's basically what Pandas was an attempt to do.
Mm-hmm. And there are numerous statements in Pandas that say that the information in life does not allow us to distinguish whether the intelligence was natural or supernatural. Explain why that is.
We were operating within the empirical domain.
Mm-hmm.
If you see written in the sand, John loves Mary, you can readily conclude that an intelligence produced it and that a clam didn't scratch that into the sand. But that if we're to see ripples on a beach, you would readily discern, and from your own range of experience, that water in the form of waves had accounted for those ripples.
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar to the type of reasoning that we make every day. We see evidence that intelligence produced something. When you find an arrowhead, you don't say, oh, look what some strange, fluky part of nature did. You recognize some intelligence fashioned it. And that's what we were looking at, is that if it is only going to be designed in the eye of the beholder, then, it depends on who's doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
But is there some way to legitimately make this objective so that anybody could recognize this? Mm-hmm. This is the way we were trying to think of it.
You said that you wanted to stay within the empirical domain.
Yes.
What does that mean with regards to whether you can infer whether the intelligence was supernatural or not supernatural?
Well, all we can do in the area of science is we're limited by our physical observation and senses, the five senses.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, we're limited. But we can make legitimate inferences, mental inferences, that we extend on from that.
Mm-hmm.
But there some people often raise the issue, well, you're just, when you talk about making an inference to intelligence, that's really God, but you don't have the courage to tell us that that's what it is. So you just use this generic term, intelligence. No, I don't. I'm being quite honest when I say this. I don't know. When I see an object, I can tell that it was intelligently produced, but I can't name the intelligence that did it. You don't have to say I have Nike written on the basketball to know that somebody made it, although you might have to have that name to tell that Nike did it.
So would you argue that intelligent design's non-identification of the designer, it stems very much from a desire to respect the limits of scientific inquiry and not go beyond what the data can tell you?
I think that's correct. I mean, I would personally, I am a Christian, and I would be very happy if there were a way I could identify and nail down and for sure that this is the God, for example, that's discussed in Genesis. But scientifically speaking, that's not possible. The issue for me is to be metaphysically or philosophically aware enough that I don't make big mistakes when I'm thinking through this this kind of thing. It's very, very large subject, and there are a lot of places to fall into the metaphysical mire, as somebody said, and I didn't want to do it.
Sure. Well, this, I think, is a good segue into why intelligent design terminology was used in pandas rather than, say, creationist terminology. What was the significance of you using intelligent design terminology rather than creationist terminology? Were you trying to cover up, you know, that this was really just creationism, or was there some other reason that you used intelligent design terminology?
Well, the same reason I already mentioned. We were trying to stay within the empirical domain. I realized that the charge is that we just tried to find a substitute word for creation, but that isn't the case at all. In the early days of writing the Pandas book, for example, although we understood what we were doing, most other people who we were talking with didn't know our objectives, really. And if you have a whole culture that knows about creation, I mean, as a term, and they bring to it all kind of backgrounds and to make an interpretation from that word. So we used that word early on, not for deception, so we could later switch and switch on them, but because we wanted the materials to be understood that we were focused on. It was always clearly within the empirical domain, even the things that we wrote early on. But the time after we had Mystery published, and I had opportunity to visit many universities and give lectures on these topics, gradually it became clear that there was a real good way in which we could make the case we wanted and completely within the empirical domain, and we looked for a term that would do this, and reading the literature, intelligent design is the most appropriate term, and that's what we did it.
And where did you find the term intelligent design? Who was using it before you that you found it from?
Well, there were a lot of people through history have used it, of course. But at the specific instance in which I found the piece that it clicked in my mind and I got on the phone and called someone and says, yes, we're going to use intelligent design, it was an optical engineer who had published an article in an optics magazine. And he had a photograph of Mars, and he was describing the objects on Mars, and he said, this has all the appearance of intelligent design. And I said, that's exactly what we want.
Okay.
That's the term we're going to use.
Wow.
Because we were already thinking this way, that there are occasions when you have, like the famous space face, for example, on Mars.
Yeah.
We know that was not artificially produced by an intelligence on Mars, although it did get a lot of ink and press over many years, but there are things that look intelligently designed. We wanted that term to use because we were going to try to say, well, we can pass over, and not only do they look like it, they really are intelligently designed.
Now, I want to ask you a point-blank question. I didn't put this question down on the list of questions, so this is out of the blue, and this is a direct question that is related to something that Darwinists will so commonly say that I just want to get it out there and get it over with. So, point-blank question. Did you switch the terms creationism and intelligent design in some effort to avoid the Edwards versus Aguillard court ruling?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. We didn't use the term intelligent design until it was after Mystery, but I'm not sure exactly where.
Okay.
But I know it had nothing to do with Edwards. In fact, we had been trying to think of a term even back in the after we completed Mystery, we began to think in terms of the biology book. And we still hadn't finished Mystery yet. We were thinking in terms of, well, what are we going to call it? How are we going to proceed? What are the objectives? And we knew we wanted to have information as the key going forward. And intelligence was part of this in our understanding even at that time.
Well, so you published Of Pandas and People in 1989. And I'd like you to just briefly, if you're willing, tell the story of when Eugenie Scott first discovered Of Pandas and People.
Well, that was an interesting story. It was at the San Diego meeting of the one of the very large educational society meetings for, I think it was the National Association of Biology Teachers is what the meeting was in San Diego. And we had gone through all the normal processes of application for having a book table at the conference, and the luck of the draw was our book table was in the basement around a corner behind the stairwell, and hardly anybody was in the morning session was finding our book table because they couldn't see us back there. And then one day, I think that later in that first day, Eugenie Scott was wandering around, and she spies us over in the corner. So she comes over, looks at the book, and just gets very excited and emotional after a few seconds. And she's looking through it and says, "Oh, my goodness alive, we can't have this here."
Did you know who she was at the time?
Yes. Okay. Oh, yes.
Okay.
I knew who she was.
Right.
And she didn't know who I was, but I knew who she was.
Okay.
And I said, "Well, what's wrong?" And she said, "Well, it looks legitimate." And so, had she said nothing, we could have gone that whole week and no one would have hardly known we were there. But as it was, she went to the podium and told the audience that there is this cheat book that got in. I don't know if she used that term or not, but anyways, this book, this trash book that should never have been allowed here. And she was going to check into how we ever got there. It had to be illegitimate. And because we were down there promoting creationism. And that was her take on it at that first day. So she's been a nemesis of not only intelligent design, but specifically of pandas ever since she first laid eyes on it.
Well, you know, I think I can explain why she went up and did that. You have to understand that I think that your book of Pandas and People has probably done more for fundraising for the NCSC than probably any other book that was ever published. You know, I have actually surveyed the NCSC website. They have over 100 different individual pages that talk about your book. So you have kept them very busy. You've given them a lot of work to do and a lot of reasons to go out and you know, don't go look at that book, but, you know, help us fight it. So I think that's the underlying message there. Anyway, I'll say it even if you know, if you don't want to say it. So I think that in the end, I just want to say thank you, Dr. Thaxton. It's not every day that we get to have somebody who has not only had such a profound scientific career and scientifically and philosophically developing the theory of intelligent design that, you know, keeps us busy here today, but also you have such just a personal connection to this whole story, and it's so wonderful to hear all these, you know, the true story, what really happened, and how the whole Darwinist meta-narrative that this is repackaged creationism, you know, really is an invention that they've come up with. It doesn't fit with what really happened because you were there and you know what happened. And they're never going to convince you that this is repackaged creationism.
That's right. That's right.
Hmm. Very interesting. Well, do you have any other comments you'd like to make in closing?
Well, keep up the good work. I would like to be able in 25 more years to come back and see how things are then.
Well, we'll put it in the calendar before we leave today. Thank you very much, Dr. Thaxton.
Very good.
It's been a pleasure interviewing you.
Very good.
This is Casey Luskin with the Idea of the Future podcast. You heard it here. The true story of the origins of intelligent design. You won't get it anywhere else. Thanks for listening.
Hello, I'm Bruce Chapman, president of Discovery Institute. The ID the Future podcast you just heard is a crucial part of the mission of the Center for Science and Culture, crucial to keeping you, our friends and supporters, informed about developments in the debate over intelligent design and evolution. Podcasts like Intelligent Design don't just come about through an unguided process or an unfunded process. That's why I'd like to ask you to help support us in whatever way you can. Please consider donating to Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture at discovery.org/CSC. You can also help support us by forwarding this podcast to family and friends and by posting links to intelligentdesign.org and discovery.org on your websites and homepages. Whatever you do, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.